Welcome to the Atonicast. I'm Ed Niedermeyer. With me, as always, is Mr. Alex Roy.
Thanks, Ed. And with us today, we have a really interesting guest and someone I want to talk to for a very long time. We have Paul Clayton, who's a director of automotive products for FLIR. Well, thank you for coming, Paul.
I appreciate you guys having me.
So FLIR is a very interesting company because FLIR makes a wide variety of imaging products. And I used a FLIR thermal camera about 10 or 12 years ago on my BMW to drive cross country as quickly as possible on one of the Cannonball records, which don't matter right now. But what did matter was at the time, it was a product that I could not order in 2003 for my car. It was a thermal camera that mounted on the front bumper, and it output a display. It was a monochrome display of animals and other cars. But what was so interesting about it was that it allowed us to see imperfections in the road at high speed. And it allowed us to drive, you know, 140, 150 miles per hour, I hate to say it, on public roads, much more safely than if we had not had it. And from 2005, 6 until 2010, when people would ask me how we, you know, drove cross country so quickly, and I talked about having bought a thermal camera, they looked at me like I was an alien, like they couldn't even imagine such units existed, you know, outside of the military. And so, which brings us to why Mr. Clayton is with us today. You know, all the talk of self-driving cars, you know, you talk about radar and camera and LIDAR, but you don't hear as much about thermal, you know, I guess infrared camera systems as I would suspect. So, Paul, I'd like to hear from you. Could you give us a little background, or a lot of background, on what FLIR manufactures broadly? And then go back and tell us about the history of FLIR and, I guess, thermal or night vision imaging products on the market.
Yeah, sure. So FLIR is an acronym. It stands for Forward-Looking Infrared. Just so happens the company named itself after that acronym. And we make, as it states, you know, infrared cameras. We make sensors that find heat, not light. So we look at heat, not light. It's a completely different part of the spectrum. And the company's been doing that since 1978 when it was founded up in Oregon. We put it in just a plethora of different market segments. Obviously, one of the main segments is surveillance. We can see things at night without any light whatsoever. So the military uses this. You'll see them put in helicopters. Sometimes you see the cop show where they're chasing bad guys, so we're in gimbals. The military uses it for you know, surveillance techniques on the bad guys, as well as some good guys. We have border surveillance when it comes to surveillance, you know, tactical people walking around and looking for people crossing borders. We have also maritime. So about 4 or 5 years ago, we bought Raymarine. And if you've ever been out on a boat at night, it's really hard to navigate. If you throw a FLIR camera up there, it just looks like daylight. So it's a lot easier to move around. We have a massive division, which is thermography, to make instruments. And a lot of contractors will come to your house. And if you live in the south like I used to in Atlanta and your windows are leaking, a contractor can scan the house as one of these thermal cameras and very quickly see where all the leaks are occurring so they can plug them. If you also live up in Vermont or New Hampshire, I used to live, and it's very cold, you can take a look at the walls of your house and see if they're fully insulated. You can see the studs, and you can see kind of almost through the wall to where you have insulation and no insulation. So our thermography division does a very good business there. And then we have my division that does OEM and emerging, which is basically we make sensors and camera cores that go into not only our products, but products worldwide. You know, FLIR is the world's largest infrared manufacturer of these type of sensors, and we're very proud of that fact, and we put them not only in our products, but in a lot of our actual competitors' products. And to your point, Alex, we also put them in cars, and it's been quite a successful business for us, but not yet in autonomous, and so we're really looking forward to doing that in the near future.
So before we get into self-driving cars, I just want to be absolutely clear about the nomenclature, because even I have mixed it up. So you say that your products see heat, but not light.
Correct.
So what is, in terms of language, just some the difference between infrared and thermal? Are these, can you define terms for us?
Yeah, sure. So infrared is actually a part of the spectrum. okay, of electromagnetic spectrum. So you've got like gamma rays, X-rays, ultraviolet, visible, infrared, microwave. So you got the visible spectrum, which is typically 400 to like 700 nanometers. That's what the eye see. That's why we call it the visible spectrum. And then hanging above that at about 700 nanometers up to about 14 microns is what you call infrared, okay? And so you've got, the industry's kind of passed these up. You've got near-infrared, which, to tell you the truth, if you get a handy cam out there, like a Sony camera or something, and pull a particular filter off of it, you can kind of see near-infrared just with a regular CMOS-type sensor. But above about 800 nanometers, you start to get into where you really have to have a specialized sensor. And in the infrared spectrum, you've got three bands that you talk about. You've got the short wave, which is typically 1 to 3 microns. You've got the medium wave, which is 3 to 5 microns. And you have the long wave, which is 8 to 14 microns. And each one of those actually requires a different type of sensor that's optimized for that spectral range. So anything in that infrared is also kind of considered thermal because it's the hot end of the spectrum. But we kind of break it down into different regimes depending on the technology you're going to use to detect with it.
When was the earliest that such systems were deployed on ground-based vehicles?
I'm not sure about the military vehicles. I think those were around, I want to say, in the 80s. I do know about the automotive, the commercial side. Alex, I think you got one of the earlier ones. That was what we call a Night Vision 1, and that started to hit the market around 2004, 2005. And that was purely an imager. So all it did was, it looked at the thermal image. You don't need headlights. You can see, as you know, you can fully see down the road. It's a very nice imaging product. That was improved in about 2007. Where the Night Vision 2 product came out, that one included analytics. So even though everyone's talking about autonomous driving, ourselves and our partner Autoleave in this actually came up with a system that detected pedestrians at night, independent of any light conditions, in about 2007. And then in 2009, we actually came out with another version, Night Vision 3, which not only does people, but animals. People tend to be a little bit more consistent than animals, and a lot of damage was being done to cars by animals, so they added the animal detection.
So I'm absolutely clear. My device, which, as you said, is just an imager, and so there's no additional software layer.
Correct. Yeah.
It sees, and then it outputs whatever it sees to a screen on the dash of my car.
Correct.
And so generation one, I guess, is what I have, which I paid for. I think I paid, it was new. I think I must have paid $3,000 or $4,000 for it. Does that make sense at the time?
Yeah, they were about 20, they retail for about 2,500, 2,600 if you go to a dealership. And that price hasn't changed, which is one of the issues we probably want to talk about later on.
In generation two, when these imagers, I guess, popped up in some higher-end vehicles, I recall that I think BMW and Mercedes-Benz at one point offered these as a standalone option for their cars. You said it was about 2009, is that correct?
2007, they came out with Night Vision 2, and 2009, they came out with Night Vision 3, which Night Vision 3 has the animal and the pedestrian detection.
To be clear, there was a software layer that would interpret the image and then put identifiers onto a display for the driver.
Yep.
Because there were so few. I mean, Ed, did you ever drive any of these cars that had, such a system installed?
No, I remember seeing ads for them, but I never actually drove one, no.
I also remember seeing ads, and I remember the options being very expensive on the websites.
Yes.
But I never recalled ever seeing anyone review them or really get into it. But I remember that the output display was, I think it was center dash. Is that correct?
It depends on the actual use. So different manufacturers have different use cases. And I got to tell you, some of them are, I find the human interface to be a little bit more useful than others. The BMW one is typically put the image in the center of the dash. That's where their screen is. Mm-hmm. Audi and Mercedes actually put it in the binnacle. So they've got these LCD screens now. So I know Mercedes for a fact, when they detect something and they think there's a hazard, they'll actually, with the LCD screen, they'll pop up the thermal image. Also, BMW, Audi, and Mercedes all have alerts now that'll ping you and also throw up an image if you have a HUD. It'll throw up a warning image up on the HUD as well.
You're already guessing where we want to go with this conversation, but I want to go through this historically sequentially. So you had these first systems in BMW and Mercedes in 07, 08, and with a software layer that would interpret the image and identify pedestrians and animals. And at that time, was there also an alert, or did the driver have to look at it and say, oh, that's a person?
So in the 2007 time frame, there was a warning. So the system would like give you an audible alert, and you would see on the screen, whether it's in front of you for an Audi, was in front of you for BMW, was in the center console. Mm-hmm. You'd see on the screen the object that's being detected in a bright yellow box.
Okay.
So if you see an animal or a person, it would be beep 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 beep. It'd be beeping at you. At the same time, you'd visibly see something on the screen.
There was a splash of PR around the release of this, but I don't remember hearing a lot cases of this, for example, failing. I mean, was there ever an incident of someone hitting something after having gotten an alert of a pedestrian or animal?
I have never heard of somebody getting alert and then hitting somebody, to tell you the truth. Now, it's there's human error involved, so I'm not saying it's never happened. You know, people are people, which is why we're going towards autonomous driving. But I've never heard of somebody getting that alert and then not being able to respond appropriately. These systems see way down the road. You know, obviously, Alex, you know this because you used it for the Cannonball, but you know, your headlights are typically saying about, you know, 30, 40 meters, maybe 50 meters max with the new headlight technology. You know, these systems, these cameras see 100 meter plus down a road. And so you have much more situational awareness. So not only is the camera seeing much further than the human eye can in those lighting conditions, but it can alert you much sooner. And so two or three times past the headlights, you have that kind of a warning that there's something there and you can take action. So it's a very good preventative accident kind of a device.
As these subsequent generations have come out, are the improvements that are happening, are they taking place purely in the sensor technology? Or it sounds like also there's a software component here with maybe image recognition and things like that that are making these systems more effective, maybe without even major changes in the sensor technology itself. Sort of, could you talk us through sort of how the sensor technology itself and then sort of this software stuff have evolved, which ones may be moving faster or how they're working together?
Yeah, actually, they've kind of worked hand in hand. That's a good question. So when the Night Vision 1 system came out, it was using, as you said, imager only, so it was fairly basic software layer just to produce the image. We might be getting ahead of ourselves, but it's a long-wave sensor, and it uses a 38-micron pixel technology. Alex, you mentioned it was fairly pricey. That's because those sensors back then, you know, weren't necessarily mass-produced and were large. And so it cost a lot to make them, although the software was fairly benign. When we transitioned to Night Vision 2, the sensor technology shrunk to 25 micron pixels. So the sensor technology got smaller, the packaging got smaller, so it was easy to put into a car. At the same time, the software with the pedestrian detection got us to that next level of feature set and value proposition. And then Night Vision 3 comes out, which is what we're shipping today, and that has a 17-micron sensor, and it's much more sensitive. So at this point, we've got better sensor technology. Again, it's smaller, it's better for packaging, and it's cheaper. So the costs have continually come down on the sensor technology, and the software value has gone up accordingly. Now, without poking anybody in the eye, the frustrating part of this is the offering, if you go into a BMW, Mercedes, Rolls-Royce, your Audi dealership, that price hasn't changed. And I think that's part of the issue with the adoption of the product itself. Even though I think suppliers have done a good job of bringing down the overall price, the cost of the product, the price still has really yet to move the needle. Yeah, so you know, I hope I'm not ticking any of my customers off, but that's just a truism. And then later this year, Peugeot has announced a little SUV in Europe. I think it's called the Crossback CS7. And that'll have Night Vision 3 on it. And they're lowering the price for the first time. So it's coming down to about $1,500, which is still what you would consider somewhat of an expensive option. But it starts to break that price barrier down to where, you know, we think it really should be. It actually should be, I think, a lot lower than that. But this is a good start. If I lived in an area where deer strikes were very common, I'd definitely get one of these units. Here's the sad part. I don't think it's until you drive a system at night with infrared, you realize what you're missing and how much more comfortable you are. I do a lot of test drives around this area, and there's a local university, UCSB, University of California, Santa Barbara, down the street. And the students there are on bicycles, they're on skateboards, they're walking all over the place. And when I drive with an infrared camera, I can see so much at night. I feel good, and when I stop driving with the infrared camera and I just use my headlights, I realize I'm much more tense. It's not until you realize and have driven an infrared sensor how much more comfortable it is.
No, see, I can completely second that, because I remember driving, well in excess of 140 miles an hour. It's many years ago. To anyone who's listening, don't hold it against me. I remember being able to see potholes, imperfections in the road, so far out that we could actually veer within the lane to avoid hitting those items, and seeing a rabbit come out and stop at the edge of the lane. So I mean, forgive me for interrupting you, but for anyone who thinks that Paul's exaggerating, on the contrary, I think it's quite the reverse. He's understating the degree of confidence one feels when you see that level of information.
And I have to tell you, Alex, the sensor technology and the image quality since you drove the Night Vision 1 has come leaps and bounds. If I compare our original product to the one we have today, it's night and day. You kind of look at the original Night Vision 1 and kind of go, ugh, that's not too good. At the time, it was kind of barrier shattering. But right now with Night Vision 3, you look at the image and it's a beautiful image, absolutely beautiful. It's just like driving in daylight. It really is.
One of your colleagues sent me a FLIR 1, I think, thing that adds onto your iPhone.
Yeah.
And I placed it on my iPhone on a mount on my windshield, and it could see further, farther, better with greater resolution. And I think this device is $300-$400.
It's actually it depends on which one you have. If you have, we're just coming out with a new FLIR 1. There's a couple of generations of it. The FLIR 1 that came out last year is probably slightly less of image quality than a Night Vision 2. But the one we have today that's shipping, I'd say it's as good a quality. The image is really nice, and that's in a much smaller, lower resolution sensor than we have in Night Vision 3 today. So the thing you're talking about, the FLIR 1, it's a quarter of the resolution that we put in cars. And yet, as you say, it matched what you had originally. So sensor technology has come a long way.
Before we get too much further into the applications and implications of this technology, could you maybe just give us a really basic sense of how these sensors actually work? And I know it's really easy in any kind of sensor technology to go way off the deep end. So just as easy as it is as possible to just kind of give a basic understanding for non-super dorks how these things work.
Yeah, I'll try to unsuper dork it. So basically, the way a thermal sensor works, and I'm specifically going to talk about long wave sensors. I talked before, we have short wave, medium wave, and long wave. The cheapest sensors to make are long wave, and those are the ones that are going in cars for cost reasons. So I'll focus on the long wave. Basically, instead of measuring light, which is what a photodetector does, it measures photons, we have to measure heat. And the way you measure heat is you have to put down, on a pixel basis, you have to put down a temperature sensitive material. And so some people use amorphous silicon, some people use vanadium oxide. It's no secret that FLIR uses vanadium oxide because the quality of the sensitivity of that material is extremely high. It's trickier to put down, it's more expensive to put down, but you get a much better image out of it. So what we do is we put down this temperature-sensitive material on a pixel. Now, the tricky part is the pixel has to be completely isolated from anything else in the sensor. Okay, because if you don't isolate it, then the sensor heat is actually affecting the signal. So this temperature-resistive material has to be put down on an elevated platform that's held up by little legs from the rest of the sensor and independent from any other pixel. So it's actually a very tiny little MEMS device, micro-machine device. It looks like basically a platform held up by two long legs that then come down and attach it to the rest of the sensor. So you have, hundreds of thousands or millions of these little pixels all together, all these little MEMS structure with temperature-sensitive material on them. And then as the heat hits it, basically the signal, it affects the resistive material, changes the current that we put through it, and that goes down underneath to the actual multiplexer. So an actual sensor is a temperature-resistive set of pixels on top of a multiplexer. And all the multiplexer does is it collects all the rows and columns of that sensor and sticks them all together into an image. That's basically how a thermal sensor works. Sounds actually pretty easy, very, very tricky to make.
Yeah, no, you've done a really good job of explaining it when technology that's that tough sounds so simple.
It's actually, if you Google thermal technology pixels, you can get a few pictures of these things. It's a lot easier to visualize it if you do that than me trying to prattle on and explain it. But basically, that's the basis of the technology.
So starting in 2007, you have the Generation 2, and the software layer that was on top of the imager. At that time, if you bought a Mercedes or a BMW that had that system, was that system ever software updated to improve its interpretation of the hardware image?
No.
Or is it a hard-coded system, and that's just what it is?
It's a hard-coded system. That had to be kind of done because there's some export concerns when you start shipping thermal sensors around the world. You have to have certain conditions that lock the camera into the ECU because in the Night Vision 1 product, it was just a camera. When you started to add the analytics, you needed a central processing unit, and that usually sat inside the car and the camera sat on the outside. But these two were tied together, and upgrading them was something that was not necessarily wanted actually by the vehicle manufacturers, so we didn't actually do that. We came out with a new version. People want, after about 5 or 6 years of offering that system, the platforms are getting old. You want to update them anyway, and so the cars stayed the way they are. And when you bought the new car, you bought the new camera.
So when you buy any of, for example, the FLIR One add-on for the phone that I've been using, but that is software updatable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. There are certain things we can push into that. It's a lot easier to do over a phone because you can push it over the airwaves than it is in a car where you might have to take it in for a service or something like that. And I know Tesla is very good at pushing, and they're breaking the paradigm of doing software updates, and they do it very well. And I can see the automakers going in that direction, but they haven't done that for our technology yet.
Well, you know where we're going with this. So, okay. So, Ed, when did Tesla begin shipping Model S's with radar and camera?
That was October of 2015, yep.
So that's when, October 2015 is when they released Autopilot, the first gen. But they were shipping vehicles with the camera and radar hardware prior to that.
Yeah, the summer before, I think August or something. Yeah.
Okay, so for end of 2014-ish.
Right.
No, mid 2015.
Okay, so at that time, Tesla had, they had a plan, whether we like it or not, they had a plan to deploy technologies which allow the vehicle to perform some functions. I'm trying to be sensitive to Ed's writing here. Some functions using cameras and radar as the sensors. Right. And they were doing some sensor fusion with the combination of Mobileye and Tesla's, I guess, own software layer, made it to Mobileye's software.
Yep.
And I don't think we don't need to belabor what's happened since then.
Right.
And the big debate is whether or not LiDAR is necessary to get to level 4 or beyond. But in this entire discussion of self-driving cars, I have heard virtually nothing about FLIR or thermal imaging sensors.
Right.
Why?
That's the $100,000 or more dollar question. So it's interesting. When I see what's out there, and you mentioned Tesla. So let's go back to Tesla to start off with.
Sure.
We have people in the office here that drive Teslas. They love their Teslas, and I think the Teslas love them back. And I drove one, and I put it in the autonomous type, mode, and it was interesting. It only turned on in certain conditions. And you get bad weather or you get bad lines in the road. You see things on the web where there's some barriers in the road, the car didn't see it. Because it does use a combination of the radar and the camera. And I think sometimes the radar says, I see something, the camera says, I don't see it. And then once something's got to make a decision. And right now, I think the way it's working is one's overriding the other. which is where there's been a few incidents. Now they're getting much better at this. They're collecting data all the time. You know, I think whether you pay for it or not, Tesla's got all the sensors on and they're collecting all that data to help them improve their system. So they've got a lot of millions of miles of data and they're getting much better. This, it can only be used in certain areas in certain conditions. And if you want a true level 4 car, level 5 car, you got to be able to completely replace the driver. He can't interrupt the car. Otherwise, you know, if you're not going to smash into something, right now it warns you, you got to take control. Level 4, level 5, you can't do that. So right now I believe car companies are using a combination of the sensors they have in the car. So what's in high volume and cost effective? Ultrasonics for short wave, for short range, for like parking, stuff like that. You've got radar for medium and long range, usually some kind of cruise control. Sometimes you use radar for blind spot detect. And then you've got cameras like Mobileye is one in particular. You have other manufacturers out there, I think like Hitachi on the Subaru EyeSight system. And they're using a combination of stereo vision or single vision to identify and classify how close I am to that car, along with some of the radar combination of information. And so the visible sensors are cheap, the radar's cheap, the ultrasonics are cheap, but they don't give you the full picture of what's going on. There's what we would call some of the corner cases, especially for autonomous driving. So people are looking at LiDAR. And to tell you the truth, Alex, what I think is happening is people are looking to LiDAR to be the global panacea if it can solve everything. And you're investing millions of dollars in this. And it's great technology, don't get me wrong. But it's got its downsides, okay? It's super expensive. If you see these spinny dome things on top of cars, they're, you know, $70,000-$80,000, which for some market segments like an autonomous taxi might work because the cost model may work out. But for every you know, Joe Blow driving down the street, you're not going to stick an $80,000 can on top of your car. So the LiDAR companies are being heavily invested in to reduce the cost and improve the signal density of the LiDAR systems. So right now you've got other companies out there who are looking at, yeah, I can get a super high resolution LiDAR image. But the way it's used in a car today, I think everyone's focusing on LiDAR and seeing that will solve everything. We don't think that's going to be the case. They're just not there yet. Most of the driving that's happening is driving in daylight. So when we talk to customers, they're very busy trying to figure out, and they're all trying to race each other to get a level 3 or a level 4 car out there, and it's under certain conditions. You know, Audi just announced the fact that they have on their new A8 a LiDAR system that's used in conjunction with the visible camera and the radar. But it's geofenced to only certain areas. You will have to have specific lines in the road. You have to have a barrier in the road, and it's limited to a certain speed. So again, they call this a level 3, but it's not truly autonomous. So everyone's rushing to try and get to that certain level, but they're not looking at, I hate to say this, some of the corner cases. So we see LiDAR and radar being used primarily for ranging, and the LiDAR for a bit of situational awareness. So it can tell where it's at, roughly what the road imperfections are, and I got objects in front of me. The problem is when you start to throw people and animals in night and light conditions, because you don't only have to have the ranging, you got to get the classification. So if you see a pole down the street on a radar and a LiDAR, the resolution isn't good enough at some distance, you know, 50, 60 meters. These sensors don't have the resolution at that range to say that's a lamppost or is it Johnny down the street? And so cameras are used for classification. They can say, okay, you see something down there. I can see it looks like a person. But the key there is they can see it looks like a person. So now what happens if you're driving down a road and the person is at night or there's oncoming glare from headlights or a low-lying sun? Now all of a sudden the camera doesn't see that person. And the person might be stepping out in front of the car, or it might be a lamppost and standing by the side of the street. You don't have to worry about it. What I truly think is happening is thermal is going to augment the visible camera for classification. And it's going to do it in all lighting conditions because we're not affected by light. We're only looking at heat. And we can do it and reduce all the clutter from the surrounding area because people and animals, you said yourself, you saw a rabbit by the side of the road, they pop out. They illuminate themselves over a very dark background. So we can clearly see things that augment the visible camera for classification. I just don't think the car manufacturers are there yet. I don't think that we're starting to see interest. I can't talk about who, But we're starting to see a lot of pull from the suppliers saying, you know, I think we want to try some thermal. And we have some customers who are very interested and think thermal is going to make a difference. They're just, you're just not hearing about it yet.
Can a thermal camera substitute for a LiDAR system? Let's talk about the cases.
Actually, you got me thinking. Now you got me thinking. You know, I think up front people are going to throw the kitchen sink at it and require a bunch of sensors.
Okay, so well, let's talk about under what conditions will a LiDAR not work?
I think right now, depending on the wavelength of the LiDAR and the range, if you want a cost-effective LiDAR system, it's going to only have a few points on target at like 70 to 100 meters, okay? So it doesn't have a good point density at range. And on top of that, depending on the target itself, if you have a person down the street wearing dark clothes, you're not going to get a lot of reflectance from them. And so, you know, LiDAR's using light.
A FLIR camera will be superior in that case, yes or no?
Correct, yes. So it's items like that, right? It's the classification. It seems pretty simple. The LiDAR and the radar give you the range. A LiDAR gives you a bit more situational awareness. A camera gives you the classification of what you're looking at. And the camera doesn't work in all lighting conditions. And so you need thermal to augment that and to also offer redundancy. So if you know if your visible camera goes down or there's an issue, the thermal can take over. If the radar goes down, the LiDAR can take over. So you know you not only have to have the capability, but the redundancy built in. You don't want to have one sensor. You know, if LiDAR gets some dirt on the lens, it's not going to work. Then you're going to have to go back to your radar system, or do you just park this car by the side of the road and call for help? So in all of these autonomous driving systems, you need redundancy. And you need safety, right? So you got, and we can offer that orthogonal measurement. It's RGBT in essence. It's you know red, blue, green, and also thermal heat. And I truly think if you look at detection and classification versus ranging, it kind of breaks down to people are going to have to use thermal eventually.
Yeah. So Mobileye is out there, you know, lobbying, and many people like George Hotz. I don't know if you're familiar. Are you familiar with George Hotz?
Mm-mm, no.
Comma AI, it doesn't matter right now. Everyone else is familiar with him, and you shouldn't care. But George Hotz is this kid. I love him, but you know he's a piece of work. His beef with Mobileye is that Mobileye has been out there lobbying various safety organizations in different countries to make Mobileye aftermarket systems mandatory and to offer insurance discounts to cab drivers and drivers who install Mobileye systems. And then the whole system is, it's fairly simple. The camera is, I'm sorry to say, junk. I've seen the raw output. It's very limited.
Yep.
And the software determines how well the system works. Software
right.
is everything.
Right.
And the hardware is totally commoditized.
Right.
Hotz and Elon Musk and a couple of people in Eastern Europe think that level 4 can be achieved with camera and radar.
Yes, yes.
And so it doesn't sound to me like you believe it can be reached even with camera, radar, and LiDAR.
I actually am somewhat of a believer. You asked me a question, I hesitated. I'm kind of a somewhat believer of the camera radar system. They do a really good job now, except the camera doesn't work in all light conditions. So you need an additional – if you put a thermal camera, a visible camera, and a radar, you've got a lot of information. I believe there's Renata, was it Ursulin, the Dr. Ursulin, who is actually at a University of Toronto, who is started like a vision lab and did a lot of great work. And is actually, I think she's the head of the Uber lab up there right now. She gave a talk at CVPR a few months ago, but also at the NVIDIA conference. And she showed what you can do with a single visible camera without even radar. And it's phenomenal the information you get, and the system is extremely capable. And the analytics are becoming very powerful with all the new CNN-type analytics that you can use. So it's a really neat technology. And I come back to the fact that she did most of the stuff and showed it could work with just a visible camera. I'm not saying it has to be a Mobileye camera, but it's just a visible camera and with the analytics. But the visible camera doesn't work in all conditions.
And also, right, it seems like those advancements, as we were saying, a lot of it really has to do with the improvement in machine learning.
Yes.
But, you know, that's taking up a huge amount of processing power, right? For a camera to look at something and sort of pattern match it in a way that it can really, with a high level of certainty, establish this is, and like the example we used in an earlier episode was, you know, this is a stop sign and not a guy wearing a funny hat. You know, that could in theory take quite a bit of process learning in the first place for the system, and then processing even once it's learned a certain amount to make this determination with a high level of certainty. Yeah. Seems to me, like if nothing else, that getting that thermal imaging layer in the mix, in the sensor fusion mix, would allow the system to, rather than going through, you know, huge amounts of processing to understand, you know, is this a person or a guy with a funny hat? You know, if it's generating heat, it's a person. Yeah. Right? I mean, it seems like it dramatically cuts down the amount of processing power that might be required to make some of these basic classifications, like you're saying.
You're absolutely right. I mean, if it, you know, I was driving down the street the other day, and there's a lamppost. It was a tall thing with a lamp on top of it, and it could look kind of like a human, to tell you the truth, because it was long with a hot pot on top. It looked like a head. And the analytics clearly said, no, that's not a human. That's a lamppost. But humans definitely pop. I mean, animals definitely pop. Humans on a bike pop. It just, the background is very cluttered in a visible environment. The camera does a good job of segmenting. You are correct, though. Ed, it's you know, you need a lot of horsepower to drive that. That said, if you see what companies like Intel and NVIDIA are doing, they're making these GPUs that are becoming very, very powerful. And you got to ask yourself, if it does come down to a camera system, visible, thermal, and radar, is it cheaper to put, you know, a couple of $1,000 GPU behind that and run the analytics? Or do you want to put multiple LiDAR systems on the car to deal with that as well? So it's very interesting. I mentioned Dr. Itzel, and she actually, at the end of her talk, she got a question from the crowd. And I think it's on tape if you pull up the video of her talk. And the question was, you did all this great work with a visible camera. Do you need LiDAR? And she kind of laughed and thought for a second. And her response was, I don't think you need it, but it's a nice to have. And, you know, I think at the beginning of autonomous driving, people want to make sure you have all of these redundant systems in place. And specifically for the use case, I think there's going to be two ways this breaks out. I think there's going to be like autonomous taxi services, like an Uber or a Lyft. I know there's a company called Zoox doing this as well. And those guys can probably afford to put a more expensive sensor suite on their cars because that cost model is like, we're using this thing 24/7. We don't want a driver. It's got to be 100% reliable in all conditions. And then you've got the people who drive their car and is, you know, like my mother, who is going to be old enough soon not to be able to drive to the store. Wouldn't it be great if she had a car that could take her to the store once or twice a week? And she likes to own her car. But the cost model there is going to be completely different because it's going to be mass-produced and she's only going to use it occasionally. So are you going to invest in all that money just for the occasional use? So I think it's going to break out into a couple of different cost models.
One of the interesting issues that we discussed with an earlier guest as well was sort of the question of how much power are these autonomous drive systems with all the sensors that they could potentially have and all the processing power that they will need, how much power are those going to take? Because especially if you're talking about an electric car, you know, energy consumption starts to eat into the range of that vehicle. So I'm wondering, just so maybe others who are looking into this more in depth might be able to start thinking about comparisons of what would a thermal camera take to run power-wise versus, you know, extra processing or LiDAR. So how much power does one of these units use?
So, you know, going back in history, when you had the 38 micron device, it was large and it was a bit power hungry. We mentioned Night Vision 3 uses a 17 micron sensor. What we're offering today as development kits into autonomous driving is the latest and greatest sensor that we have. It's a 12 micron sensor. And a 12-micron sensor, it can come in different flavors, but typically we're at like 300 milliwatts to drive that camera, which is fairly low power.
And what kind of range does that have?
It depends on the model. If you use a QVGA sensor, you can typically get about 100-120-meter range. And if you use a VGA, you're getting 200-250-meter range to detect people. That's actual detection.
Right. And is there research going on? Because as we were discussing with Mobileye, right, the hardware there is fairly commodified because it's a camera. Cameras have been commodified for a while. But what they're able to do on the software side is really changing rapidly and opening new possibilities. So on the software side, is there maybe academic research? Or I'm sure you guys have your own in-house R&D. But especially with neural networks and things like that, are there unique things that neural networks hooked up to a thermal camera can do that maybe an optical camera, a system hooked up to an optical camera can't?
We might be cheating a little bit here, and I hate to say that, but let me ask the question. So, yes, we do have an internal team, and yes, we are using neural net, and we're using GPUs. And what we did, which what we found very interesting, was there's millions of hours of research that's gone into neural net using visible cameras. Well, so guess what? In a thermal camera, a person kind of looks like a person in daylight. It's just we see it in, slightly differently, but pretty much the same. So what we found is by leveraging the work that's done in open source analytics on visible and adding some thermal images so the system can, this is a learning system, right? So the system can kind of learn some differences between what a thermal human looks like and what a visible human looks like. It doesn't take a lot of extra effort before you've got really good analytics working in thermal. You just need some thermal images for the system to learn. And so not only are we offering the new 12-micron sensor, which is lower cost, low power, but our group is in the process of traveling all over and capturing thermal images of cows and deers and people and bicyclists and motorcyclists and, kangaroos. And we're going to offer that to some of our customers so they can develop their own analytics. What we find is, as much as we can develop our own and we have them and we can show that we can detect things using these analytics, the customers have their own way of doing it and feel comfortable with it. What they need is the additional thermal information to get them to that next level. But again, we're kind of so-called cheating off of what already is existing in the visible space and leveraging that with our thermal library. So we can get people up to speed very quickly.
Okay, so, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this similarity to an optical system as well, it makes it seem as if it would be fairly easy to integrate that into a sensor fusion sort of situation. You wouldn't need entirely new approach to that, or maybe I'm wrong about that.
That's absolutely right. It's very similar to a visible camera. We put out a 14 or 16 bit raw data goes right into their system and can be seen just like basically the image looks like a visible image. The computer sees something different, but the human eye, it's kind of correlates to what the human eye sees.
If someone is, for example, running a autonomous car startup or something and is interested in sort of, plugging in with these development kits and some of these options that you have, how would they go about sort of getting involved with that?
Well, it's actually fairly easy. We have something called an auto dev kit. It's an ADK. It's on our FLIR website. And basically it's a complete kit. We sell a camera, a new 12-micron camera. It comes in a completely IP67 type housing. The unfortunate thing about infrared, if people aren't aware of it, is it doesn't see through glass. So glass absorbs infrared, so it's got to be on the outside of a car. Most of these sensors you see on the car and these autonomous driving things are stuck on the roof anyway. But unlike Mobileye and the visible cameras that are behind a windscreen and nicely protected, infrared cameras have to be on the outside. So we offer this kit where we put the camera inside a waterproof housing. It's got a window on it, a protective window on it. It's got either a USB or a GMSL cable coming out the back of it, and it comes with a software kit. You put it on a PC, or you can put it on whatever computer you're using. You plug it in, and you hit go, and it records the data for you that you can put directly into your analytics. It literally is. We've made it plug and play.
Is it possible for you to share maybe companies that are doing some of this development work, or is this confidential?
I'm sorry. we got NDAs with all of them, so I'm not allowed to say anything. We have a lot, and we're getting a lot more interest over time. We brought this ADK kit out towards the beginning of the year, and we had some interest, and it's picking up exponentially. So I see the pull coming as people get more experience with the corner cases. They understand they're going to have to augment the visible camera somehow. And they're also concerned that as much as LiDAR is being touted, a lot of people said it's going to become high density and it's going to be, really cheap. There's some massive barriers to overcome there. And so people are starting to look at the alternate cheaper technology they can use. And thermal is one of them.
Yeah, and it also just seems to me that some of the smarter people I've spoken to, obviously everyone working in this field is incredibly smart, but some a lot of people seem to be saying more and more that there's almost no end to the redundancy that you need in order to really make these systems safe? You know, can you make a car drive through a maze? Sure. Can you make it, you know, drive in complex traffic situations with the kind of reliability you need not to get the pantsuit off you? That requires serious levels of redundancy. And it seems like even, you know, I mean, I think with Tesla Autopilot, I think one of the questions about whether it can do full self-driving with the current hardware is whether or not there's enough redundancy there. Yeah, so I think that's something that's becoming a bigger question, right?
I'll give you a use case. You're driving down the road, and let's just say a person is walking between a parked truck and a parked car, like people cut between them. You know, a radar system is going to see a lot of reflected signals. They may not see that half a person sticking up above the car. The LiDAR system is going to see a cluttered environment. It probably doesn't have the definition at a distance, say, I don't know, 40, 50 meters, to see that person either. If it's daylight, the visible camera is going to see the top of that person. I've got to tell you, analytics are good enough to see that person and go, whoa, somebody's going to about to step out in front of the car.
Right.
The thermal, but the thermal at night, when the visible camera doesn't work, is also going to see that person. Not only that, they're going to pop out as this really highlighted image against a dark background, and it's going to be very simple to see them.
Obviously, a lot of talk about full autonomy, level 4, level 5, where the human's completely out of the loop. But and these lower levels of automation, which is what you're seeing right now, one of the things that Alex and I have been talking a lot about, and actually one of the things we actually agree on, is that it's really smart for companies to start moving in a direction of rather than trying to take the human out of the loop wherever possible, but then having to hand control back and forth, to do a sort of parallel autonomy approach where or a human-centric automation, or there's lots of different words, augmented driving is Alex's term, where you're actually just trying to use new sensor technologies and even processing technologies and things like that to basically improve the ability of the human driver to identify obstacles or issues and to just make them a safer, better driver. So is that something, because, you know, as you were saying, these camera systems have been available on higher end cars for a while now, but the price has been right, kind of high. Do you think that the rise of automation has sort of generated more interest, not just in full autonomy, but also in just, you know, giving humans more sensors so that they can have more information with which to make smart driving decisions?
You know, I wish that was the case. I'm not sure that the Joe Blow public are appreciative of what goes into these things. You know, if you talk about the Mobileye, where if I'm not paying attention, I'm going to hit the car in front, but the car will brake for you now. It'll stop. I think people appreciate that when it happens, but it's not that they really get the full understanding and learn from it. I hate to say that. I think they become reliant on it. So I think what's going to happen is you may actually dumb some people down. You know, my lane keep assist, my auto cruise control, I can read my newspaper if I'm stuck in traffic. I'm not going to pay attention. If I'm going to hit a car in front, my car's going to stop. I don't have to pay as much attention anymore. I hate to say this, I think it's kind of the opposite. I think people are going to take these things for granted. I think autonomous driving, we're going to creep up on it with a bunch of these autonomous systems. And as we do so, I think the customers are going to rely on them more and more and not necessarily learn from it, but maybe dumb down from it.
Hmm. Have there been new developments in display technologies that allow you, right? Because this is one thing you have the sensor and obviously you guys have been iterating that and improving that and the software that goes with it to recognize what it's seeing. But then also the other part of this is display. And you mentioned some of it were in the binnacle and some of it were on the, you know, instrument cluster and the main screen. And so I'm wondering, you know, whether heads up display, augmented reality, anything like that, are these areas where you're seeing new opportunities to take this data or these, you know, this sensor information and display it to drivers in new ways?
Well, that's a great question. So yes, I do think HUDs are a great way to display the information. The human interface. I got to say, after driving these cars and seeing the display, having to look at the display, it's like anything. If you look at the display, you're looking down. You're not necessarily paying attention. Now, if you're looking just an infrared image, you can see everything by looking at your display anyway. It's kind of okay. But the best human interface I've seen so far, at least when it comes to thermal, is in Europe. Some of the German manufacturers offer something called a dynamic spot, and I've driven it, and it is phenomenal. And what you realize when you drive this thing is you don't want to see a display. And you can Google this, but this what this dynamic spot or actually does is it's a directed little very narrow beam of intense light that typically comes out of a specific type of a fog light. And so using a night vision system, we could detect the person out way past where your headlights are. If it detects somebody, these little spotlights come on, and they'll identify with a very narrow beam of light. They'll lock onto the person, and they'll track the person or the animal, and they'll track it. Wow. And after you drive that system, what you realize is, I now completely understand where this thing is, person, animal, whatever. I can't see it yet, visibly, the system has, but I know exactly where it is, and I know where it's going because I'm seeing the thing track it and move.
That is fascinating.
And then you realize, I don't want to look down at a display. I don't want to have to look down. I'm looking out. I want that the situational awareness. As a driver, I want to be looking out, but I know where things are. And this system can track multiple. Typically, it tracks the nearest object to you, but because it's two fog lights, it can track either side of the car. It's phenomenal. It really is. You should Google it and take a look at it.
I'm looking at it right now, and I'm curious because I'm looking at a video. It's a BMW video. It's called Night Vision with Dynamic Light Spot and Animal Detection.
That's
and
it.
I can see this, the left half of the screen, it's showing me this beam,
yes.
I guess, over the windshield that's yep. flashing on an animal. So, yeah. So I just want to understand this clearly. So this system would flash lights, it would flash an part of the LED element
yes.
on the road.
Yep.
So this is not projected onto the windshield. This is actually... Yep. On the road.
Right, exactly.
Okay, very interesting.
It's not only cool, but I've driven one, and what's interesting is it can identify people and animals, whatever, and you think, well, it's going to blind people. It's a very intense beam of light. But if you actually get out and look towards the car when it's happening, a car's coming towards you at headlights, and all you actually see is light. You get just flooded with headlights anyway. You don't notice the little narrow beam, but behind the driver's wheel, you do. Now, that is when that is an awesome system. People should check it out. Now, in America, unfortunately, it's not legal yet. I think they're trying to get the rule overturned to where it will be legal. I think they're trying to vote on the rule at the end of this year. Hopefully next year it's a system that people can get a hold of. But that's if a person's driving. But what it tells you is if a person's not driving and it's an autonomous car, do you really need a display at all? Your mobile eye when it breaks because there's a car in front of you, maybe you don't know why it breaks. I think there's going to have to be some indication at the beginning, some indication that I'm stopping the car because there's a person in front of me in the road. You can't see yet, but I can. Okay, and so if it's at night and the autonomous car's driving along and all of a sudden just stops, you're going to wonder if it's broken or not. You're going to have some indication of what's going on. So there's going to have to be some display of some kind, some alert on the head-up display. I personally think the dynamic spot technique is a phenomenal technique, and I hope it gets adopted.
Yeah, I think Alex and I are going to have to go on a road trip in Europe and try this out sometime.
Let's hang on a second. So this video that I found, which demonstrates this, is from September of 2013. So that's 4 years ago.
Yeah.
So is this system on the market in Europe right now?
Yes, you can buy it in a BMW. I think Audi or Mercedes has it right now.
Has FLIR or anyone been lobbying, the DOT in the United States this whole time to make this legal here?
So we partner with a company called Autoliv for Night Vision 1, 2, and 3, and they're a big Swedish safety company. And they're the ones who actually do on the night vision systems, not the autonomous driving, but on the night vision systems, they actually did the analytics. And they've been pushing NHTSA, and they've been kind of proposing that, look, guys, this is a safety concern, and this is something that we really, really would like to have. And they're the ones who provide that service in Europe, and we're hoping they can lobby the NHTSA and get it changed in the U.S. as well. I think it's a great system.
It's a fascinating system, but it's just, it really highlights the complete disconnect between, these government agencies saying they care about safety, and yet all the focus is on level 4 and 5 technologies that are
right.
many years away, and yet this right. is something that's available in Europe. And I've heard of it, but I assumed it had gone away, like literally disappeared.
No, you guys should contact Autoliv and ask them for a demo. It's a phenomenal. It's really is. I'll go to a road trip and drive a car and drive it in a rural environment. And if you don't see anybody, Ed, you pop out. Alex, you drive towards them, and it's just trust me, you won't hit him because you'll see him.
Yeah.
Unless you see him and aim for him, that's a different thing entirely.
That's what I would be worried about.
Is there a FLIR? I mean, you have a lot of products. So, you know, is there a FLIR unit aftermarket that I can go and buy and put on my dash, which will provide alerts in the event of an animal or pedestrian in front of the vehicle, the way a Mobileye aftermarket device does?
So we do have a system called Pathfinder 2, and it's actually the same system, Night Vision 3. It's the same system that's in the Mercedes, Audi, BMW today. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we provide the stuff to Autoleave. We sell it ourselves. And so it does – you can retrofit it into a car, and it does put the yellow detection boxes. What it doesn't do is necessarily, like, jam the brakes on or anything else like mm-hmm. that. We're not at that level yet. That's more of an autonomous function. Mm-hmm. And you have to be very tied to an automaker. So FLIR typically is a Tier 2 supplier. We supply to the Autoleaves, the Continentals, and people like that. Maybe some people like Zoox or you know, a Waymo would be interested. But we typically are a Tier 2, so we don't actually integrate it into the car itself. We leave that to the Tier 1.
And if are there any insurance companies that offer a discount for someone who has this such a system installed?
Boy, you're reading my mind. We're actually trying to work with some companies right now in the insurance. Deer strikes are actually, I hate to say this, you know, as much as you don't want to hit a person, deer strikes are much more prevalent. I think a couple of years ago I got some stats that in the U.S. alone there's over 1 million deer strikes, 200 fatalities for people, and 25,000 injuries for people, but 1 million deer strikes that create, you know, $3.5 billion worth of property damage. And so we're trying to get the insurance companies to actually give a discount. The problem is they need hard data. They need to show me the statistics that say you can reduce it by X amount and I can offer the discount. And gathering that information is very arduous, and it's something we're looking at right now. But yeah, it's a great point. Economically, we'd like to get people a discount by using this technology, because not only will it save their car or save a life, but, you know, maybe they can save some money at the same time.
Yeah, because I was in an Uber last night in New York, and it was the fifth or sixth Uber I'd been in where, actually, I'm lying, it was a Lyft, because I don't like Uber. But the drivers all had a hardwired aftermarket Mobileye system that beeped incessantly. And they said they hated it, but they were required to use it. I'm not quite sure who required it.
Well, it's interesting because even in New York in an urban environment, I'm not so sure the visible cameras work well at night. Mm-hmm. You know, now Intel has bought Mobileye, mm-hmm. so I've got a feeling you're going to have a juggernaut of development that comes out of that now. But again, you get to the point where it's going off all the time. You really want to understand and get better analytics to make it go off just when you need it to.
Right.
And that's the key, because if it's annoying, people are going to ignore it and turn it off. You know, it's like the seatbelt sensor. Everybody hates the ping of the seatbelt sensor. It's the same thing.
If there's any time that you want sort of a backseat driver, someone helping you out, it's at night. I mean, for me personally, anyway, my night vision is not great, and I hate people sort of looking over my shoulder when I'm driving during the day. But at night, like every little bit of help really helps.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so my last question, because we're coming up on an hour, although I have another 2 hours of questions to ask you. If I was going to go cross country again and break many laws, and I wanted to replace my FLIR camera on the front bumper of my car, the current generation unit would be a Pathfinder 2 or this Tau 2 or Boson unit.
Well, the Boson unit is the 12 micron technology we're pushing towards autonomous cars. Uh-huh. That's not in a package with analytics that we're selling to the public yet. Uh-huh. So the one that's available today. Not that I'm saying you should go break the laws, but if you wanted to drive at night and have all the safety features, it's the Pathfinder 2. Yes.
Okay. And can I disable the safety features and just use it as a camera? can I bypass the software layer and just have the raw image?
It's going to show you the raw image no matter what.
Okay.
And I mean, I guess the answer is no. It's not going to be beeping at you, so you don't have to be annoyed. It'll just show the image. So I think you're all set.
Yeah, it sounds like if you want to get into the weeds, then one of these developer kits and the Boson unit is what you want, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Mr. Clayton. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, appreciate it.
It seems like we're going to have you back in the near future when one or more car manufacturers come out with a FLIR system integrated into their autonomous driving package.
I got to tell you, as soon as it happens, I'll call you guys up and let you know. How's that sound?
Please do.
Please do.
I also, I mean, my takeaway from this, and I don't know, is that there is a vast untapped market for driver augmentation, and that I think we're going to see that in the coming years before we see level 4 and 5. And I think FLIR will end up being part of that package.
I think you're right, and I'm hoping we can be definitely a part of it.
Well, thanks so much.
Yeah, thank you. If there's is there some way that if people want to learn more about FLIR or maybe follow you on Twitter or anything like that, is there somewhere where people can find either you or the company?
Sure. FLIR.com. We're on there. And, you know, if they can contact me, paul.clayton@flir.com, and zing me any messages, any questions. I'll be more than happy to answer them.
Ed, where can we learn more about you?
Well, I'm on Twitter @Tweetermeyer. And Alex?
I'm AlexRoy144 on all platforms.
All right. Well, once again, Paul Clayton, thank you so much for making the time to speak with us. And we look forward to hearing more.
Yeah, appreciate it, guys. Thanks for the time.